Thank you. My name's Whip Smith, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. And I've been sober all day this day, only by the grace of a loving God, and from following direction of people before me. Some of you are here, and some of you have gone on. But that's the reason I'm sober today, because I tried every way in this world to not get sober. I gave up all hope of being sober. And finally, when I got to that point, I was able to get sober, and I'll share that with you a little later on. First, I want to thank the committee. Groves invited me up here, and my wife's with me, and I want to introduce Linda at this time. Linda. And that ain't bad for a South Georgia drunk. But I do appreciate it. Linda and I have had a wonderful time. A lot of people up here we had met before. A lot of people that we hadn't met, and we've become friends, and Jerry, and, you know, this program, like he says, continuously to amaze me. There's nothing to this. It's what goes on, and I want to thank, and all of you know who you are, for the people that stood out in the parking lot after the meetings that were held here and shared with me a little bit about you and let me share a little bit about myself with you, and some of the pain seems to go away. And the people over in the motel that took time to stop by and give me a few minutes of your time and tell me a little bit about what's going on in your life. And I really and truly believe that that's all Alcoholics Anonymous is. And this is my opinion, is one drunk sharing with another drunk. But we do appreciate being here. It's been great up until this point. I told Bob, I said everything was rolling along pretty good until Mo got through last night. And I suddenly realized that I was next out of the chute. And I went to the motel, and I couldn't sleep. And I got up and tried to pray a little bit, and the whole transformer blowed out over there. So I was in a mess. Before I get started here this morning, I would like to say something. We have a couple here that's celebrating their 6th anniversary today, and these people I did not know prior to coming up here. And I had lunch with them yesterday, and have come like everybody else to just love a complete stranger because of the common bond that we all have. And they're going to kill me, but Tom and Paula, will y'all stand up? I told you my name, and that's who I am, and I told you that I'm an alcoholic, and that's what I am. And I'm reminded each time that I share from the podium something my sponsor told me, and it still works today. He says, Rip, if it hasn't happened to you, you don't have any business sharing. But if it's happened to you, then you have a right to share it. And that's what I'm going to try to do this morning, is share my experience and my strength and my hope. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says that we tell in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like today. And that's what I'm going to try to give you. I'm going to try to give you real, as I've learned that who I really was and what really happened to me and what I'm trying to do with that today. Now, many, many times in my life, I was able to stop drinking alcohol, and Rip didn't get no better. The circumstances got a little better, but Rip didn't get any better. And I kept going that pattern over and over into my life. People would say, Rip, if you'll just stop drinking, you'll be okay. And I was able to stop drinking, but I'm here to tell you, Rip didn't get okay. And as a result of me not being able to live in this world and faced the reality of this world, I always went back to drinking. My problem, as I understand it, is not stopping drinking. My problem is trying to find a way to where it won't be necessary to start back drinking. And I finally kept hanging around AA and listening and talking to people, and some things went on in my life that I'll share with you, until I finally discovered the solution to really what was wrong with Rip. And why Rip didn't feel good, and why Rip couldn't exist out there in that world, whether I was drinking or not drinking, it really had nothing to do with it. And that's what I'm going to try to do this morning. And as I understand the program of recovery, Rip's real problem started long before I ever drank the alcohol. And the best I can put it together, Rip's real problem started when I was a little kid and I was about 6 years old. And it was a morning such as this. It was Sunday morning, and my mother got me up and she dressed me one more time to carry me to church. Now, I had already become a Baptist, and I didn't even know what they were, but that's what they told me I was. And I didn't agree or disagree. I just did what they told me to do. But this particular Sunday morning, she dressed me up, and I can remember this as well as I can remember my drinks. I can remember this as well as the jail houses, and it must be some significant in my life. So when she dressed me up this Sunday morning, it was a little white suit and it was trimmed in red and it had short leggings. That's what we wore back then. And I didn't want to wear that suit. And I got mad. And this is what Rip told Rip. If your mother really loved you, she wouldn't make you wear this. She doesn't love you. She's punishing you. And I told me that, and I believed that, until I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I stuffed that down in there, and I toted that with me everywhere I went. Shortly after that, I heard that same mother saying some prayers at night, and her prayers went something like this: Dear Lord, if my son ever takes a drink of liquor, I hope you'll take his breath. Now I knew, mother doesn't love me. Mother doesn't want me. And I felt that, and I believed that, and I told Rip that. And I stuffed that, and I walked with it. Shortly after that, I was enrolled in school. And I went to school, and I began to look around and observe the other people in that school. And I'd see somebody that had something a little better than I had, and I blamed Mother. I said, if my mother loved me, I would have as good as they have. Now get this. I never had the ability to look at anyone in that school that had less than I had. I always looked at the people that had more than I had. And I never had that ability. This drunk never had that ability to look at anyone that had less than I had, until I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Also in that school, I felt unwanted. I felt unloved based on what was already going on in my life. And I'd see somebody that didn't have something, and I'd see this person that had it, and I'd go steal it from the person that had it and give it to the person that didn't have it, hoping, just hoping, that they would love me. And I began to live that kind of a life because that's what I had formulated up here in this computer. Had nothing to do with this. It was this. And this is the way I started out in life, and this is the kind of person that Rip Smith really became. I was introduced to alcohol long before I ever drank the alcohol. My father drank the alcohol. He drank a lot of alcohol. But me and my father had a good relationship. Because I knew this, if my father was drinking a whole lot of alcohol, just stay out of his way. What I couldn't figure out was what was wrong with Mother. Mother didn't drink alcohol. And mother was the one that I disliked. So I knew the problems that alcohol would cause long before I ever drank. I had a great knowledge of that. And I knew, and I probably, like a lot of other people, said, I'll never drink this stuff. But this is the kind of guy that I really was. These are the feelings that I had. And I hadn't taken a drink yet, folks. But this was me. And this, each time I stopped drinking alcohol, this is the person that I reverted back to. There's my problem. At the age of 16 years old, after a football game one night, I took my first drink. It was a Budweiser beer. I can remember it very distinctly. There was three of us, and after the beer, we went and we bought some old cheap wine. We had no money. We scuffled up enough to get a bottle of cheap wine. And then we bought a cigar. None of us smoked, but we were big shots. And I drank the beer, and I didn't drink that beer because I loved it. It was the gosh-awfulest taste I'd ever put in my mouth. But I drank that beer, and I made myself drink that beer because those other two guys was drinking that beer, and I wanted to be a part of them. And I made myself do that. I didn't enjoy it. I went and got the wine, and we did the same thing with the wine, and I forced mine down. And then I smoked the cigar, and something happened. And I think any alcoholic here this morning knows what happened. For a brief period of time, Rip Smith got okay. I just leveled out. I didn't hate nobody. And I really didn't care whether anybody liked me or not. I was just melancholy in there, and I was okay. But then I did, like a lot of you did. I got sick. I threw up. They carried me home, and I lied about the whole deal. But I did one thing. I got up the next morning, and I remembered how I had felt for a brief period of time. And I began to put this computer to work up here, and I said, why did I get so sick? And this is why that cigar is so significant in my life, that first cigar. When I put it all together, I said, the cigar is what caused the trouble. Now, people, for the next 30 years, I drank alcoholically, and every time I got in trouble, I blamed it on something other than the alcohol. And it's really that simple. I come out of the gate like that, and I continued that. It was always somebody or something that caused the trouble. It was never the alcohol, and it was never Rip. It was circumstances. I graduated from this school, and I moved down to Waycross, and I became employed with the old Atlantic Coastline Railroad down there. And I worked there for 1 year, and I was drafted into the Korean conflict, and I went over to Korea and served my time after 16 weeks of training here in the States. And the only thing that I can really tell you about the military in Korea was it was a marvelous place for a person like me to drink. It was cheap. And it was accepted over there, and we kept it in our foot lockers, and that's when I was introduced. If you get up in the morning and you're feeling kind of bad, if you can get a drink down, you'll feel better. And that's what I learned in Korea. And if I got into any trouble, the MPs would carry me back to my outfit, and that was the end of that. I was able to survive the ordeal, and I was given an honorably discharge, and I came back to Waycross to resume my career there with the railroad. Now, at this point in my life, I knew that there was something wrong with me. I had come in contact with people from every walk of life in the military, and I had never known anyone like me. Because they would talk about how much they loved their family. And they would talk about this. And I wasn't like that. See, I had all of this stuff just stuffed in there. And I didn't know how to do nothing else. So I got back to Waycross and I began to inquire around to some people that I thought had some good knowledge, and they did. And they suggested that maybe I needed to get back into the church. And I did that. And I went back over there and I joined this Baptist church and I became very, very active in this Baptist church. I was teaching a group of young people in Sunday school every morning. We had a building project going on over there, and I'd get off from work and I'd go there and I'd work and work and I'd do everything. And I'll tell you why I did that. I did that because I wanted them people to approve of me. I wanted them to like me. It had nothing to do with God whatsoever. I was out trying to impress people with me because I wanted to be accepted. And I sat there in that church and I did one thing while I was in that church. I was able to lie, manipulate, and con, because that's all I know how to do, a young lady into becoming my wife. And she bought it hook, line, and sinker. And we were married, and God was good to us, and we was blessed with two wonderful children. But I'm an alcoholic already, and my disease is progressing. And the marriage began to come apart after several years. And it was her fault, and it was everybody's fault. Now, I look back in my life at this particular time. I had everything in this world any normal human being could have wanted. I had a good job. I had a good wife. I had a world of friends. And I had two wonderful children. Now, I truly believe that an idiot would have quit drinking alcohol at that time. But I know this morning that an alcoholic cannot quit. And I continued to do whatever I had to do. And I had become this kind of a person. I'll do what I want to do, when I want to do it, and how I want to do it. And you can't win like that. But that's all I knew to do. If an idea popped into my mind, that's the thing to do. And I went and did that. And I got in a lot of trouble doing that. But see, it wasn't me. It was the circumstances surrounding that. My wife couldn't stand it any longer, and she put me out. She kicked me out of that home, and thank God she did. And it took me a long time to be able to stand at a podium and tell people that. But I know the blessing of that today, because, see, I know a little bit about alcoholism, and I didn't know anything about it then. And I know a little bit about the family disease of alcoholism, and I didn't know anything about that then. But she put me out to go to the gutter because that's where I was on the way to. And as a result of that, that woman and those two children are somewhat whatever normal is supposed to be, and I haven't figured that out yet. But that answer will come. And if they'd have held on to me, I'd have carried them to that gutter with me. Not that I wanted to. I would have hated that, but they would have went with me if they'll hold on to me. It's my privilege today to work with a lot of alcoholics, and I see the alcoholic drag the gutter into the home and destroy the home. And I wasn't allowed to do that, and that's become a blessing in my life. It got real bad when she put me out. I was eat up with resentment, self-pity. I continued to work, and I had become the daily drinker now. I drank too much at night, but I have the solution for that. I get up in the morning, and I take a few drinks, and I feel better. And I go out there, and I perform that job, and then when I get off, I can do some serious drinking then. And that's the kind of life that I live. I overdid it one night. I wasn't supposed to go to work the next day. I was working in transportation, and I had went to this bar, and not knowing that I was going to have to go to work, but I went home drunk, our little old trailer that I was staying in, and And they called me to go to work, and I told them I couldn't, and they told me that I had to, and I went out there, and I was fired. And I was fired because I was drunk whenever I got out there. And for the next year, I roamed the streets of Waycross, and I sought my own gutter. I used, lied, conned, cheated, and manipulated. I did whatever I had to do to get to whatever I thought I needed at that particular time. And after about a year, I had ran out, and I was down on Memorial Drive, and I was staying in back of an old service station down there that a friend of mine ran. And I had taken up my few little belongings, and I was living in a wrecked automobile in back of that service station. And a friend came to see me one day. I knew of this guy. I didn't know anything about him. We had worked at that railroad somewhat together, and I just knew him. And I knew one thing. I knew that he didn't drink. But, you know, I knew several people that didn't drink. And I didn't really want to spend a whole lot of time around him, but he came back there to see me one morning. And I'll never forget this, and hope I never forget it. He came back there, and he told me, he said, "Rip," he said, "I want to help you." And I asked him why. And he gave me the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, "Rip, I want to help you because somebody came and helped me one time." I didn't call this man, folks. This man came to see me. And I know why today. I didn't know why that morning. See, this man came to see me because he was an alcoholic and he wanted to stay sober. That's why he came to see me. And he sat there and he told me a little bit about himself. And he said, "Rip, if you'll do what I want you to do, or what I ask you to do," he said, "I think I can help you get that job back." Now, folks, I heard "job back." Because I had used everything in this body, anybody that would allow me to. And an alcoholic needs some source to keep that booze coming. And I heard "job back." And this was in the year 1973. And they had started a state-owned treatment facility there in Waycross. And he says, "If you'll go there and try to get your life straightened out," he said, "I'll help you go back to work." And I went there. And that's when I heard about your 12 steps, and I quickly memorized them. And I heard about your 12 traditions, and the easy does. And my mind was in pretty good shape back then, and I could grasp all of this stuff. And I memorized every bit of it. And at the end of 28 days, I left from that place, and I swore that I'd never take another drink of liquor. And 3 days later, they hauled me back in there, drunk, because I left from there the same person that went in there. I left from there with the same ideas that I left the church for. I left everywhere that I went with the same set of principles of living by that I had when I went in there. Nothing had changed. I hadn't drank in 28 days. The first day I was out, I moved into a halfway house. I had fallen in love with some woman in that treatment center, and I took off to see her, and we both got drunk. But I was put back in there and for 5 days, and I was detoxed, and I moved into this halfway house. We call it the Serenity House there in Waycross. And I began probably the most awesome, horrible 10 years of existence on the face of this earth. And here I was. I would try to stay dry for a few days, and I'd go to a meeting, and I'd hear some idiot jump up there and talk about how grateful he was, and me living in a halfway house, no family, everything was gone, and I'd leave that meeting and go get drunk. And I'd ease back into that halfway house late at night, and they probably knew it, but they were giving me a chance. Or either I'd take a drink and go to the meeting, and I was in a mess. But let me tell you about Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't care how I went to Alcoholics Anonymous, drinking, sober, or dry, Alcoholics Anonymous never changed. They took me by my hand and they hugged me and they said, "Rick, we love you. Come on in and have a cup of coffee." And thank God Alcoholics Anonymous done that, because I kept going. It didn't matter what condition I was in. I was never belligerent. There was something there. I had no idea what it was except for one thing. These people would accept me just the way I was. And I kept going. I began to wind up in institutions. I met Gus over here. I think it was 74. I don't know. We woke up in a detox unit together. And this became a pattern of my life. But get this. Each time I went in, I left the same person that I was when I went in, except I wasn't drinking. I didn't know how to live. I did not know how to get out here and face reality. And the pain would come so unbearable, but back in this thing it says a drink will help you. And I began to do that. And I kept going to Alcoholics Anonymous, and nobody ever told me I couldn't. And I existed like this for about 7 years. Now, what I really want to tell you about a drunk a lot is the last 2 years that this drunk drank. I went completely crazy. I had lost everything, and there's a lot in here that I'm not going to go into details about, because you know what goes on in the life of an alcoholic. And the last 2 years, I was crazy. Now, let me tell you, folks, circumstances were better. I was living in a house. It was somebody else's house. But I wasn't living in a car. I had a job. I had a few dollars. And that's about all I had. But circumstances. And I got so angry. And I got so mad. And when I couldn't blame one other person, I blamed God. And I'd sit there at the house, and I'd read the paper to where some prominent citizen had died. And I'd curse God because I wanted to die and I couldn't die. And I reached a point, I heard Mo speak of oblivion last night, and that's what I was seeking, but I couldn't find it. No matter how much I drank, when I got through, I was in worse shape than I was before I ever started drinking. And I couldn't get nothing to happen. I was existing. And I was just a hurl inside. And nothing would happen. And my head was just constantly swirling. And I could not get one clear thought into my head. I was a zombie. And I was going to work. And I drank enough before I'd go to work to where I wouldn't shake and come to pieces before I got off. And just prior to getting off, I began to tremble, but I got the answer to that. It's behind the seat in that truck that I'm driving to work. And I go out there, and I crank up that truck, and I reach back there, and I take a drink. And I'm on the way home, and what I'm doing now is I'm hoping that when I get home, I can do some real drinking, and just maybe tonight I can sleep. But it ain't going to come, because it hadn't came in a long, long time. And nothing will happen. And I'm just sick, sick. I had quit going to AA the last 2 years. I didn't go back. And the reason I didn't go back is I was ashamed to. I had nothing. And I'm full of hate. And I'm full of anger. And I'm full of self-pity. And I'm just full of everything. and this liquor won't work no more. In May of 1983, something happened to this drunk. I don't take any credit for it whatsoever. I got up, it was May the 1st, 1983, and that morning was no different than any morning had ever been for a long, long time. And I reached in the icebox and I got that can of beer because, see, I've slept for a couple hours and I need a drink. And I pour it down and I reach in there and I get another because I knew about that second one there. Maybe things will settle just a little bit. And I drank that beer. And I got to do something with Rip. I can't be still. I'm ashamed to go anywhere except to work, and I'm off today. And I look about that guy that had came back there in back of that service station that day and told me that he wanted to help me and told me about himself. I picked up the phone. This guy was working now for the railroad, working with drunks. That's all he did was go around and try to help people that was affected by alcoholism. And I called him, and his name was Sonny. Some of you know him. And I called him, and he said, "Rip, how you doing?" And I said, "I ain't doing too good." And he said, "Well, that figures." I said, "Sonny, I'd like to talk to you." And he says, "Would you like for me to come over, or would you like to come over to my home?" He lived across town. And I'll never forget this. I said, "Sonny, I'll come over there. I'm okay." And folks, I was. At that particular moment, I was okay. And I got into my truck, and I drove over there, and I walked in, and there was Sonny. And Sonny, one more time, he said, "Rip, I want to try to help you." I said, "I'll do anything that you ask me to do." I had told him that before. He says, "Can you make it till tomorrow?" And I said, "Sure, Sonny. I've been making it for a long, long time." He said, "If you'll make it till tomorrow, I'll be by at 9 o'clock. And I'm going to get you and I'm going to carry you to a place. And just maybe they can help you." And I said, "Okay." And I left that man's house. I don't remember any more about the rest of that day. I continued to drink because, see, if I don't drink now, I got to go to the emergency room. And they're going to laugh at me because I'm coming to pieces. And I know about the hallucinations and the DTs and all of that. But I found a solution for that. Just keep drinking. I remember that night I threw some stuff in a suitcase and I got up the next morning. I slept for a couple hours. It was the same routine. And I reached in the icebox and I got that can of beer and it was May the 2nd now. And I looked at my watch and it was a quarter to nine and Sonny said he'd been by at nine and I expected him. And I remember the can of beer out there in that old truck that had flopped around back there and all the paint was knocked off of it, but I knew it was a can of beer. And I went out there and I drank that can of beer to try to get me settled down waiting on Sonny. And it hadn't been necessary for me to take a drink since that day. I didn't know what was fixing to happen. Sonny came by and he loaded me up. And he carried me over to Statesboro, Georgia, and that wasn't no big deal. I'd been in several of those places, you know. I had given up hope. I had accepted that this is the way life was supposed to be based on what I had been. That this is the way that God was punishing me. And I accepted that He had a right to if this was that God. I was there and detoxed and a counselor came by and sat down and talked to me after about 5 days. And he said, "Rip, you've had a heck of a time." And I said, "Yeah, I sure have." He said, "I want to ask you a few questions." And I said, "Go ahead." He said, "Do you believe in God?" And I said, "There's no way in this world I can believe in God." And he said, "That's okay." He said, "Do you believe in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous? And I said, yes. He says, how in this world do you believe in it? And you've never been able to stay sober. I said, I've been going to Alcoholics Anonymous for 8 years. And I've seen people like me stay sober. And that's why I believe in it. I don't think it'll work for me, but I know it works for people like me. Thank God nobody ever told me I couldn't come back to one of those meetings. I had witnessed that in those 8 years, that there was something here for a drunk like me to be able to stay sober, and I had no hope that I could grasp that. He pulled out a yellow ledger and he said, I want you to do something for me. And if he'd asked me in any other way, the belligerent person that I was, I'd have probably said no. But see, this man was a recovering alcoholic. He had told me enough about himself that I knew that this guy had been where I had been. He said, Rick, will you do it for me? And I said, yes. And he wrote me down a little prayer on that yellow ledger. He says, every morning when you get up, I want you to ask God, a God that you don't understand and you don't have to understand. I just want you to ask Him to help you to stay sober. And He said, don't you dare ask Him for anything else. And I said, why? Because He says, if you do, you'll mess it up. And He had me. I had never made a sincere prayer in my life. It was always, if you'll do this, I'll do that. And if I ever made a sincere one before I could get through running my mouth, I had it messed up with some deal. He said, if you're able to go that day without drinking, he says at night, I want you to thank this God that you don't understand and you don't have to understand. But I want you to thank Him for helping you to stay sober this day. And he said, Rip, don't thank Him for nothing else, because if you do, you'll mess that prayer up. And that's the truth, folks. I did that. I began to do that for this man. Not that I had any hope, but I did it. I fell in love with this drunk. And I said, I'm going to do this. And I began that somewhat of a routine of asking God, that I knew nothing about, to help me to stay sober, and being careful not to ask Him for anything else, and thanking Him at night. I left this place to return to Waycross. There was nothing new about that except that I was scared to death. And thank God for the fear. I've heard that mentioned from this podium this weekend. And they told me, Sonny had told me about a meeting that was started there in Waycross, and it meets every morning at 11 o'clock. And he said, I want you to try to leave in time to get back to that meeting. And I did. And I walked into that meeting that morning at 11 o'clock. One of the first persons I saw was old Randy over there. And Randy and I drank liquor for a long, long time together, and we railroaded for a long, long time together. But he was there. And I looked around, and I saw some other people that I had long forgotten. Some of them, I thought, had passed away or moved away, and some of them thought the same about me. But that became my home group, and we call it the Dixie Group, and we meet at 11 o'clock in the morning. Now it's on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and if you're ever in Waycross, stop by with us at 11 o'clock in the morning. We'd love to have you. But I began somewhat of my trek into sobriety, and I began to go to two meetings a day. I didn't understand what they were talking about, but I went, and I kept saying that silly prayer. And I was thinking of it, referring to it as the silly prayer. And after I was there for a period of time, an old man began to take up a lot of time with me. And he began to carry me to meetings. And he began to share himself with me. This man knew so much about me. I didn't know anything about him, but he knew so much about me. And thank God for him. This man never hollered at me. This man never cussed me. But this man showed me love of one human being for another human being. And I fell in love with him. His name was Jew. He's passed away now. But this is what Jup did for me. It wasn't what Rip did. It's what he done for me. And he became my sponsor. I never asked that man to be my sponsor. See, he knew my condition. And he knew what I needed. I had no idea what I needed. I was still in that delusion, you know, well, I've quit drinking and everything's going to get great. He knew better. He knew better. And so we began somewhat of a journey, and thank God for him. We'd go to meetings, and I'd see Jup how he acted. People would use him, and they would abuse him, and he'd smile at them and walk away. And my thinking was, Jup, why don't you shoot him? He said, I'll rip, give them the right to be. He started that from day one. Give them the right to be. I said, to be what? He said, to be anything you choose for them to be. But once you label, you got to give them the right. And I began to somewhat practice that on a limited basis. And we travel. We travel all over South Georgia. He carried me to the first conference. I didn't know anything like this even existed. He carried me. Bob and Ruth were sending him tapes, and he'd give me them tapes. And man, I'd go home at night. I still can't sleep. I'd go home at night after a meeting, and I'd wear them old tapes out, playing them over and over. And over. But what I got out of that, I began to understand some words. I began to understand that words didn't mean what I thought they meant. And then about 2 years into this deal with Juke, and let me tell you about Juke, what I really did, folks. I began, and I don't recommend this, but I'm telling you what Rip Smith did. I began to act like Juke. And when I began to act like Juke, I got better. Because I was acting like somebody different than who I really was. And later on he explained to me, I shared this with him, and he said, Rip, that's the way we do it. It's a program of action. You act yourself into sober thinking. And folks, all of my life I had tried to think myself into sober act. And that's the way I did it, by imitating someone else and finding out there was a different way to live that was far superior than what Rip's ideas were. And I took his ideas and slowly began to replace my ideas with his ideas of how to live. And I suddenly realized one night on the way to a meeting, I hadn't wanted to take a drink. That compulsion hadn't hit me. The idea has not hit me. And this is what I said. I guess that little prayer's working. I think I'll just keep doing that. 2 years into this deal, Juke carried me over to Columbus, Georgia to a state convention. And on Sunday morning, I'll never forget that man. I later on was able to meet him, and he's passed on now. But he stood at a podium such as this and began to try to share. I didn't know why I was sober. I had no idea why I was sober. I was expecting any day for this doom to jump in on me, and I was going to get drunk. I didn't want to get drunk. Fear kept me going to the meetings. It wasn't no fantastic idea, Rip. Yo told me, he said, if you don't go, you'll get drunk. And I had that constant fear, and thank God for it. Fear became a positive factor in my life, and it still is today. If I don't do this, I'll get drunk. But we went over to Columbus, and this old man was sharing that morning, and his life and his thinking and all related so much to mine. And he used a word over there that Sunday morning that I'd never heard of in my life. He shared that he was sober because of divine intervention into his life. Now, folks, everybody in South Georgia had intervened into my life to no avail. The job, the wives, and I could stay here for 3 hours just talking about wives. That's plural. But everybody had tried to help me to get sober. When he talked about what happened in his life and divine intervention, I remember sweeping the carport off and something happened. And I also was 2 years now, and I knew without any reservation a little bit about what was really going on. I knew that that prayer to that God that I didn't know anything about was going to work anyway. Because Juk had long ago told me, he says, God's not interested in what you believe in. He's interested in how you live your life. And I was living my life different now. And I began somewhat of a conscious contact with something, and the best I could do was, this power is my buddy. And I just think I'll just take Buddy with me. And he told me, he said, everywhere you go, you take Buddy. And if you don't take him, he won't go. So I began to do that, and some of the fear began to go away. But I was still this mess about mother. I had did a four-step to the best of my ability, but I was still angry at mother. My mother had been dead for 5 years. I had stood over her grave. I had stood over my father's grave. I was supposed to cry. I wanted to cry, and I couldn't cry. And I felt like an idiot. But here we were, 2 years now, and I'm still hating mother. And I went into a meeting one afternoon, and they had started another meeting down there, and it was 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and I knew that I had to do something or another, and I didn't know what to do. And for the first time in my life, I brought that out. And a good friend of mine that's in the hospital this morning, he introduced me to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, Rip, I know what's wrong with you, and I know the solution. And he turned to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous back there to the chapter of Freedom of Bondage. And he told me what I needed to do. And I left that meeting that day early, and I began to do that. I began that prayer. And that book tells me today that if you have this resentment, and you haven't been able to get rid of it, this will work. And I believe that. And I started that process, and I don't know what day it happened on. But I got up one day, and I suddenly became aware that my mother loved me. My mother dressed me up that Sunday morning because she loved me and she was proud of me. My mother said those prayers because, see, mother knew about alcoholism. She had lived in alcoholism. And she knew what a drink of liquor would do to her son that she loved so much. And me and my mother has been okay ever since. And thank God for that. And thank God for the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because that did two things for me. Number one, it sold me on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Juk told me, and I believe this today, there ain't but one program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's in the first 164 pages of the big book. And he told me that there is a solution in those 164 pages. Now, for anything that goes on in my life, there is a solution in there. And I have not found that to be untrue. That is the truth. And Bob and Ruth over here, and thank God for them, you know. They just keep sending out them old tapes. And I got a set of the big book tapes that Bob had sent out, Joe and Chai. And I began to really find out what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous was. Jewett got real sick. And Rip got real angry. And I'm telling you just the way it was. He couldn't go to meetings. And I got mad at him. And I got real, real angry. A guy with 5 days of sobriety straightened me out on that. He had known Juke. He had had some continuous sobriety. And he had gotten drunk and he just seemed couldn't get back. But he heard me talking about Juke one morning in a meeting. About Juke ought to be coming to these meetings. See, I didn't know Juke was dying. He said, Rip, he said, Juke has told you all of your life to give everybody the right to be. And he said, here you are, a man that has done so much for you, and you can't even give him the right to be sick. And one more time, a guy with 5 days of sobriety straightened this drunk out. And he was right. And so I had to go back and do what I needed to do about that deal. December of 1990, Juke passed away. And it was tough. But like a lot of other things, you people had given me the tools to accept that with. It wasn't easy. It wasn't fun. And I had to go through that, what I call a normal grieving process, because, folks, this man meant so much to me. The best friend I'd ever had in my life. And he had taught me so much, not with his mouth, but with his actions. And we buried Juke. I was with him the last day, but he was in a coma, and you know, I don't know. He might have knew that, or he might have not known that. And it's really immaterial. I was there, and then we buried Juke, and I went through that grieving process, and it was tough, like I said. And a year later, I was at a conference up in Helen, Georgia. And I suddenly realized that night in Helen, Georgia, I began to look at a crowd such as this. And so many people that this man had introduced me to. And as a result of him helping me, so many people that I had met in this Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that night in Helen, Georgia, I realized that I really hadn't lost a joke. That I had gained hundreds of jukes. Some of you in this audience today, jukes. And I got okay with that deal. In 1987, I tore up my back out there at the railroad, and right prior to that, I had begun to meet Linda at a lot of conferences. She had just came out of a disastrous marriage, and for the first time in a long, long time, I didn't have one. And and we began to see each other at conferences such as this, and she had become real active in service work within the state, and through good sponsorship, I had become active in service work within the state. I can't stand up here and tell you that I just wanted to do that deal, but I was told that I needed to do that, and I'd gotten in service work, so Linda and I became great friends. And finally, I mustered up enough courage after a couple of years of this friendship to ask her if I could come to see her. She lived about 70 miles from me. And I was on the way over to see her, and I passed through this small town, and I became real, real scared. I didn't know why. But see, you people had told me when I got like that to look inside of me and see really what was bothering me. And I found a gift. I looked in there and I suddenly realized I was on the way to see this beautiful person. And I didn't want to hurt her. And I didn't want to con her. And I didn't want to manipulate her. And I'd never had that feeling before. And I also remember that the gift was given to me to be able to cry again. And that was a blessing. What I'm trying to tell you is what's been given to Rip Smith. Not what I've given back, but what's been given to Rip Smith. What this program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the God that Rip understands a little today. I don't understand him as much as I probably should understand him. But on the other hand, I understand him more than I've ever understood. And I'm all right with that deal. And this stuff that goes away from down in here and we shut this thing down and something happens in here and you just know that you're okay. And that's the feelings that I get when I get around you people. So Linda and I was married, and like I said, I've had several marriages. So what's a marriage? And I really and truly mean that. The greatest thing that Linda and I have today is we're still friends. I'd never had that before. I never knew how to be a friend to a wife. I took hostages myself. Yeah, that's what I did. And I don't want to do that no more. I don't want to do that no more. So, this is where we at. And like I said, when I got all right with Mother, I knew I was on the way then. And that's really where I'm at today. There's a lot of things that's happened in the last several years that's been bad. When I gave up that job at the railroad, they told me I couldn't work anymore. I had to accept the reality of that. And I got all right. But I'm thoroughly convinced of this today. And you people had told me this sitting in these meeting halls. God never closes one door that He doesn't open another. And I know that today, so I believe that today. I was given an opportunity to work with alcoholics. And that's what I'm doing today, is the best way that I can. And see, I'm an alcoholic, and I went crazy with that. I don't know how to do anything just a little bit. And I went too far with that, and I punished Rip. And I drove Rip too hard and threw people in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. They were able to tell me what I was doing wrong, that I was pushing Rip too hard. And they told me to back off and just try to do a little bit of it. And they sent me home and I rested for a couple of months and I got all right. And that's what I'm trying to do today, is use some discipline in what I do with Rip, you know, and not go wide open. And that's been another blessing to me. But I'm all right with that today. But it's only what people has done. If I've said anything here today that makes any sense to anybody, I'll guarantee you somebody else told me that. Because when I came here, I was void of anything that was good. I was void of anything that was moral. And I was void of anything that was spiritual. I run off a Rip's brain. I can do it. I can handle it. And I don't need anyone. And I'm not like that anymore. And thank God to people like you. I've been up here attempting to tell you what I was like and what happened to me and what I'm trying to do today. And each time in closing, I always like to leave this because I think it better explains it than anything that I've already said to you this morning. And it goes like this. I was in this forest and I was lost. And I didn't know the way out. But a hand was extended to me. And I like to call this hand the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this hand spoke to me. And it said, Riff, you're in this forest and you're lost. But I know the way out. And if you'll take my hand and hold my hand, I'll lead you out of this forest. Now, you may have felt a rougher hand, a smoother hand, a stronger hand, or a weaker hand. But you've never felt a hand that extends to you the love that this hand extends. Now, please, don't walk in front of me. Don't walk behind me. But just walk by my side and hold my hand. We're going to encounter many quickmires and stumbling stones before we get out of this forest. But see, if you walk by my hand, side, and hold my hand, you might stumble, but I won't let you fall. Now, just as we begin to get to the edge of the forest, and you can see a ray of light, please don't turn my hand loose and say, I can do it alone, because if you do, you'll get lost again. But when I've led you safely out of the forest, and you know the way out, then it'll be your responsibility to go back into that forest and lead another drunk out. Thank you, and God bless you.